repose within the girdle of these walls. Suppose and imagination. I want everybody to close your eyes again. I've been doing this each day that I've talked. And I just want you to sort of clear it out for a minute. And think of your favorite childhood or fairy tale story. Your favorite one from your youth, if you can. It should be a story that has human beings in it. Now focus on one character from that story. One particular character from that story. Try to picture that character as fully as you can in your mind. So you see a picture of that character standing before you. Now imagine that that character is black. That character is Asian. That character, if it is male, becomes female. And if it is female, it becomes male. That character is homosexual. Okay, open your eyes. Give me some reactions, and just right off the top of your head.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine Red Riding Hood as a male.
Okay.
I tried, but it didn't seem right.
Okay, okay.
I could make a black and oriental without a problem, but I couldn't change her sex.
Couldn't change her sex.
No.
And I couldn't see the little match girl as homosexual.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else?
I couldn't even think of a favorite story.
Anybody else? Reaction. I think for all of us that especially those of us that work in the theater and those of us that have attended theater or attend performances of any kind, there are a number of built-in preconceptions. When you go to see a performance of some kind, you have certain preconceptions that you already are prepared to respond to in a particular way. Obviously, when you go to a play that is labeled as a musical, what do you expect is going to happen?
Music.
You're going to hear music and probably some dancing and people and characters. You also have a preconception that it's probably going to be light. It's probably going to be humorous. In terms of theater, especially over the last 30, 40 years, probably since World War II, our preconceptions of what is a theatrical event have been flipped around quite a bit, and they keep being flipped around. And what we may have been used to accepting as theater, either when we were young or when we first came into contact with theater, may not be the same kind of theater that exists today. I was telling someone, when I was here last at Holden in 1968, the Village Center was still using the stage for most presentations on the end of the Village Center, and as a result, that setup seemed very traditional and very much as most theaters in this country and other countries have been. I think it's quite unique now that the stage in that place is in the center with the audience on three sides. I also find all kind of parallels between theater and churches, because traditionally churches were very much proscenium oriented, and now more and more churches also are developing a thrust type of staging with the audience or the congregation closer to the stage area or the altar area in the church. So I think a lot of our ways of looking, especially at the performance arts and in particular theater, have been changed and continue to undergo changes based upon our perceptions and based upon what happens in society. I'm going to just very quickly show a picture. This is from an issue of American Theater Magazine, too. I'm just going to show you the picture on the front of this magazine, and I just want you to look at the picture. Just look at the picture very carefully. Don't read any of the writing. Just look at the picture, if you will. And tell me as much as you can about what you remember of that picture as you looked at it. Just impressions.
Somewhat seductive looking woman holding a fan.
Somewhat seductive looking woman holding a fan. Okay.
You know what I got the feeling was that it was an impersonator.
Mm-hmm. An impersonator.
Not sure what they're wearing. Maybe something draped may have been a loose fitting gloves.
Somehow it didn't look contemporary. It looks like it was sometime out in the past. It struck me as being out of the 20s. I may be wrong, but...
Okay. Anybody else?
Looking over the back of a chair?
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay. I will end the suspense. It indeed is a man. Harvey Firestone from play Torch Song Trilogy, which is regarded as a landmark play in terms of gay theater because it won a Tony Award. And to achieve that kind of an award for a play about homosexuality and the gay lifestyle was a major achievement in terms of changes that had happened in society. All elements of society, I think, have undergone some of the same kind of changes. Throughout history, theater has presented itself as a community in which people of like thinking can get together to share not only their lifestyle, but reaffirm each other in terms of those kinds of theater. The best kind of art, it seems to me, the best kind of theater, in effect, has the ability to take a particular experience of a particular group of people and transform that experience into an experience that becomes universal. That's really what the basis of theater is about, and if theater is doing its job, that's what should do. What was this country like in terms of its peoples and how its peoples thought about themselves prior to World War II? I'm talking about the United States now. Give me some...
Rephrase that again.
How did this country feel about itself in terms of its peoples prior to World War II, say from the turn of the century up to World War II? Any adjectives that
Melting pot.
Melting pot.
Okay, that's probably the greatest adjective, isn't it? Up until World War II, there was this general feeling that people from all nationalities, all ethnic backgrounds, came to this country into the big melting pot, and what does the melting pot do?
It homogenizes
everybody, and everybody became, and what was the ideal everybody in America was hoping to become?
Wealthy.
There was, you get a good job, you rise, you become one of the middle class people.
Mainstream
like everybody else, and you have a home, you have a family, you have security for your home and family, and you raise. Well, World War II did a number of things in this country to upset and tip over the melting pot. And that's also been reflected in the art. One of the huge things that it did was very clearly identify certain groups of people. And if you think of World War II, immediately, what group of people, what two groups of people do you most quickly identify as an ethnic group of people?
Japanese.
Yeah. Japanese as one, and if you've been listening to any of Paul Nakamura's lectures, you know what that did in our country. And what else?
Germans,
but...
I was thinking of the enemies that we were supposed to...
Germans as well as the enemy, but another group of people that really became identified, who stepped out of this melting pot again, was the Jew. Because all of a sudden there was, because of World War II, a very high consciousness of what it was to be Jewish. And there were also some lesser kinds of things that happened after World War II. Because in World War II, certain segments of society were told that they could do and carry on for this country, help the country, and they did. But after World War II, they were told to step back and resume their prior roles. The biggest group of people that this applied to was to women, because women were forced to go into factories and all the others and take on the job of the men, and then immediately after World War II, they were told to step back in the kitchen again. The same thing happened to the blacks in the country. The blacks fought as soldiers in World War II, and yet they were supposed to come back after World War II and step back into society in their lesser status. Now, that all had a real impact on what was happening in American society, because many of these groups just refused to step back and did not become the same quiet and reserved kind of people they had been before. And what happened in theater is that writers in theater started responding to some of these issues, but unfortunately most of the writers in theater had traditionally been white and male and straight and generally pretty well off. And to respond to those kind of experiences from outside of the experience was a really difficult kind of process. And it became a crucial function for the minority peoples to begin to produce their own literature. And I think it happened in other forms of literature before it happened in drama. Drama was really slow in coming along. And it still is really slow in coming along. I maintain that writing plays is the hardest kind of writing you can do. the most difficult. Poets sometimes would argue with me, but in drama, technically, all you have to tell your story is dialogue. Just people talking. Yes, if you read a play, you have descriptions. And I always laugh at my college students because when I start directing a play, they will read the stage directions that are written in the play and follow them very, very specifically because they assume that the playwright had written them. And unless you're reading George Bernard Shaw, who did indeed write pages and pages of exactly how he wanted the plays to be presented, most stage directions in plays were written by stage managers who were watching a production of the play staged by a director and then wrote how what that production looked like so they could publish a script from it. Probably the purest kind of theater that you see is Shakespeare in script, even though that was written down afterwards, but all you really get is the dialogue except for exeunt and enter. But when you write dialogue, you have to write with the voice of the people that you're trying to write for. And how can someone who is white, upper middle class, really have a handle on how black people speak or what motivates them to speak in a certain way? Now, Paul and I would probably go, Paul Olson, who's doing black poetry, and I would probably go around about this a little bit, because I think it many playwrights have, white playwrights, have done a fairly good job in presenting black characters. But traditionally, in the movies and on television and in the theater, we have been given black playwrights or white playwrights presenting black characters who are stereotypical. You know, in the early film, the Step and Fetch It type of characters. Black theater in this country really got its first strongest voice from a woman in the mid-50s. Her name was Lorraine Hansberry. And her play, A Raisin in the Sun, probably did more for black people in the 50s than any other writer because she was speaking with a black voice. And she presented a black family on stage. Now, I know we have lived in the Cosby generation for the last couple of years, but there have been very few black families that have been presented to Americans. And in The Raisin in the Sun, she presents the younger family. The title, Raisin in the Sun, comes from a poem by Langston Hughes, and I thought to kind of introduce the scene I'm reading, I would read the poem. And this is the poem that from which the title of the play comes. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? Raisin in the Sun. Raisin in the Sun is a play about a black family who lives in an apartment in the inner city, in a typical black neighborhood. And the mother, the matriarch of this family, Mama, has money that she has used to buy a house in the suburbs. Now, you've got to place this when this play was written. and staged in 1959. The unique thing is that there was a lot of battles before she got it produced, before it was actually produced. In fact, just this last year, a new production was staged, and it was filmed for PBS. If you ever get a chance to watch it, it's quite interesting, because there are a lot of things in A Raisin in the Sun, in this new production, that weren't in the original play, because they couldn't be said on the stage in 1959. So things have come a little way in 30 years. But I'm going to read just a short scene to give you a feeling of some of the ground that Lorraine Hansberry was dealing with at this time. The scene is later in the play, and remember I told you that Mama has bought this property in the suburbs, and a visitor comes to visit the family. Now, the characters in this scene are Mama's son, Walter, who works as a chauffeur, and he's got big dreams of trying to make it on his own and establish himself. His wife, Ruth, who's pregnant at this time, and they have a little 11-year-old boy, and Walter's sister, Benita, who is ready to go to medical school. She's a good student, but she's also become involved with an African student, and the family is a little worried about this because she's been to college and she is beginning to be concerned about things like civil rights and so forth. When a man, Mr. Lindner, arrives, and Mr. Lindner enters, and Walter says, "Have a seat. I'm Mrs. Younger's son. I look after most of her business matters." Ruth and Benita exchange amused glances. By the way, I'm reading stage directions because I want you to picture what was done probably in the production. The man regarding Walter and sitting. "Well, my name is Carl Lindner." Walter stretching out his hand. "Walter Younger, this is my wife," Ruth nods politely, "and my sister." "Lindner, how do you do?" Walter amiably, as he sits himself easily on a chair, leaning with interest forward on his knees, looking expectantly into the newcomer's face. "What can we do for you, Mr. Lindner?" Lindner, some minor shuffling of the hat and briefcase on his knees. "Well, I'm a representative of the Clybourne Park Improvement Association." Walter, pointing. "Why don't you sit your things down on the floor?" Lindner, "Oh, yes, thank you." He slides the briefcase and hat under the chair. "And as I was saying, I am from the Clybourne Park Improvement Association, and we have brought to our attention at the last meeting that you people, or at least your mother, has bought a piece of residential property at," he digs for the slip of paper again, 406 Clybourne Street. Walter, "That's right. Care for something to drink? Ruth, get Mr. Lindner a beer." No, really, thank you very much, but no, thank you. Ruth, innocently, "Some coffee?" "Thank you, nothing at all." Benita is watching the man carefully. Lindner, "Well, I don't know how much you folks know about our organization. He is a gentleman, thoughtful and somewhat labored in his manner. It is one of these community organizations set up to look after, oh, you know, things like block upkeep and special projects. And we also have what we call our new neighbors orientation committee." Benita, dryly, "Yes, and what do they do?" Lindner, turning a little to her and then returning to his main force, to Walter. "Well, it's what you call sort of a welcoming committee, I guess. I mean, I'm the chairman of the committee, go around and see the new people who move into the neighborhood and sort of give them the lowdown on the way we do things in Clybourne Park." Benita, with appreciation of the two meanings which escape Ruth and Walter, "Uh-huh." Lindner, "We also have the category of what the association calls special community problems." Benita, "Yes, and what are some of those?" Walter, Girl, let the man talk. Thank you. I would sort of like to explain this thing in my own way. I mean, I want to explain to you in a certain way. Walter, go ahead. Well, yes, I'm going to try to get right to the point. I'm sure you will appreciate that in the long run. Benita, yes. Walter, be still now. Linder, well, Ruth, still innocently, would you like another chair? You don't look comfortable. Linder, more frustrated than annoyed. No, thank you very much. Please. To get to the point, I'm sure you people must be aware of some of the incidents which have happened in various parts of the city when colored people have moved into certain areas. Benita exhales heavily and starts tossing a piece of fruit up and down in the air. Well, because we have what I think is going to be a unique type of organization in American community life, not only do we deplore that kind of thing, but we are trying to do something about it. Benita stops tossing and turns with a new and quizzical interest to the man. We feel that the most of the trouble in this world, when you come right down to it, most of the trouble exists because people just don't sit down and talk to each other. Ruth, nodding as she might in church, pleased with the remark. You can say that again, mister. That we don't try hard enough is in this world to understand the other fellow's problem, the other guy's point of view. Ruth, now that's right. Benita and Walter merely watch and listen with genuine interest. Yes, and that's the way we feel out in Clybourne Park. And that's why I was elected to come here this afternoon and talk to you people. Friendly like, you know, the way people should talk to each other and see if I couldn't find some way to work this thing out. As I say, the whole business is a matter of caring about the other fellow. Anybody can see that you are a nice family of folks, hard-working and honest, I'm sure. Benita frowns slightly, quizzically, her head tilted, regarding him. Today, everybody knows what it means to be on the outside of something. And, of course, there is always somebody who is out there to take advantage of people who don't always understand. Walter, what do you mean? Well, you see, our community is made up of people who've worked hard as the dickens for years to build up that little community. They're not rich and fancy people, just hard-working, honest people who don't really have much but those little homes and a dream of the kind of community they want to raise their children in. Now, I don't say we are perfect, and there's a lot wrong in some of the things we want, but you've got to admit that a man, right or wrong, has the right to want to have the neighborhood he lives in a certain kind of way. And at that moment, the overwhelming majority of our people out there feel that people get along better, take more of a common interest in the life of the community when they share a common background. I want you to believe me when I tell you that race prejudice simply doesn't enter into it. It's a matter of the people of Clybourne Park believing, rightly or wrongly, as I say, that for the happiness of all concerned, that our Negro families are happier when they live in their own communities. Benita, with a grand and bitter gesture. This, friends, is the welcoming committee. That stuff in 1959, on a major stage and on major stages through the country, not only brought questions and problems out in the open that were indeed happening around the country, but also let black audiences connect with some of those issues, and being able to communicate that whole idea that Mr. Linder talked about, the ability to communicate with whites, but also the ability to communicate with each other. Now, what happened over the next 10 years, of course, we all know. And I want to read a very short play, a complete play, written in 1969. And again, those of you who were here the other day for my reading, you know all the things that happened in 1969. This play is written by Ed Bullins, one of the 60s black writers. And Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin the Sun was a gentle family story this is a little bit different and is quite appropriate, I think, for this year as well and some of the things that have happened in Washington. The play is called American Flag Ritual, a short play. We see a young black man. He enters. Under his arm is a bulky object tied by cord. The man kneels and unties the bundle. Carefully, he winds the cord into a ball and deposits it into his pocket. After he pulls his hand from his pocket, he stands, looks down at the unwrapped bundle, then kneels again. He slowly unfolds a large American flag. Faint music in the background. Music to suggest a solemn, ceremonious, religious, official public act is to be performed. The flag is unfolded. The man stands in its center, just a bit southeast of the field of blue and white stars. He reaches into his pants fly, pulls his penis from his pants, and upon the initial tones of the American national anthem, begins to urinate on Old Glory. As he relieves himself, the music plays and finally dies down and stops as his last drops dribble to an end. Of guerrilla theater, theater that was symbolic, non-realistic, non-literal, theater that blew open images. And as that started happening, people reacted in various ways. What was your reaction to that last reading, even 20 years later, in 1989?
Pretty sad.
In what way?
I think it was sad for the participant, and I think it's a sad reflection on our country, and I think it's a sad thing for Old Glory. I think it encompasses a whole networking of things.
Mm-hmm. I go stronger. I found it disgusting. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else share that view in terms of
it was meant to be disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
something that you were expected to do that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It means another constitutional amendment.
that's why I said somebody told me that in Chicago, I don't know if anybody here from Chicago, but that one of the big controversies in Chicago this last year was an art exhibit in which there was a painting on the wall. Well, there were two controversies. One painting on the wall, and the other, right below the painting, was a place where you could sign your name. And in order to sign your name, you had to step on the flag. And it created a huge controversy. And I guess they eventually removed the exhibit from the art gallery. But those kinds of symbolic gestures, and really theatrical gestures, still exist. There were other things that were happening that were kind of shocking in terms of our imaginations and our suppositions about how life was supposed to be. And on the stage, sometimes those things reach out and grab you a lot more than other places. How many people have ever seen a play with complete nudity in it?
The musical Hair.
That was really the first Broadway production in Old Calcutta. Equus later in the 70s of the top name plays. My first play was a play called Jack, A Trip, written in the mid-60s in Minneapolis. I remember taking a girlfriend to it on our first date, and I did.
Last date?
And I was completely shocked because everybody took off their clothes and then started wandering through the audience. Strange thing. But a lot of those things happened. One of the major events on Broadway in the 60s was was a play called The Great White Hope by Howard Sackler. Does anybody know that play or has seen the play? It was made into a movie as well. James Earl Jones and Jane Alexander played it on Broadway and also did the movie. It's a play about Jack Jefferson, who was the first, well, Jack Johnson in the play, they call him Jefferson, who was the first black heavyweight champion of this country in about 1908. I think he beat
Jeffries.
He beat Jeffers. John Jeffries,
yeah.
I think. Anyway, he was eventually, he was virtually unstoppable. He was kind of like the Iron Mike Tyson of his day. And when the play was produced, of course, Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, was sort of the reigning champion, even though at the time the play was produced, Cassius Clay had his title stripped from him because he refused the draft based upon religious grounds and beliefs. When the play was produced on Broadway, it reflected the real life of Jack Johnson, who had a white mistress. And in the play, there is a lot of romantic interplay between the two. And one of the scenes opens up with Jack Johnson and his girlfriend in bed. And it's a very tender, moving love scene, at the end of which police burst into the room and drag him off for violating the Mann Act, taking someone across state lines for immoral purposes. And he gets kicked out of the country eventually, or is forced to go to Canada or jail. And so he goes to Canada and ends up in Mexico and finally tries to have his comeback to... They had up to this time kept trying to find a great white hope. And you sometimes hear this in boxing circles even today. They're looking for the great white hope to win the heavyweight world championship back for the white man. But the whole play centers on those issues. And eventually in the play, they're destitute in Mexico, Jack and his girlfriend, and there's an incredible tense scene in which he beats her up. They have this argument, and he's trying to force her to go home, to leave him. So he picks up a towel and just beats her on the stage. When I directed the play, there were a number of interesting things that happened. In today, I don't think we think that much about interracial couples as much. We still notice them, but it doesn't have the same impact. But to present an interracial love scene on stage in the 60s was still ground that was not trod on before. When I directed the production, one of the interesting things that I noticed was that a lot of interracial couples came to see the play. And for me, that said that in some ways they were looking for reinforcement and support of their relationship. But I also noticed a really interesting thing, that at the moment the scene in which Jack beat his girlfriend, these couples would just very subtly, and I watched the audience night after night, subtly would move away from each other. And there was just a real barrier between them, which was an interesting phenomenon. But that play caused an incredible amount of furor at the time it was produced, and they had to give the actors unlisted phone numbers, and they had to provide guards at the doors of the theater. And this was in New York City in 1969. Because of threats that existed and still does exist. which means that in some ways the play was doing its work. In my particular production, the play also became the focus of a racial incident, which had nothing to do with racism, but had to do with economics, but it turned into a racial incident and became a rallying cry for theater people in the Twin Cities, and became an united black theater in the Twin Cities area, and really started black theater in the Twin Cities area. Although, as the person sort of at the eye of the storm during that time, it was a very frustrating time for me. The actor playing the lead in the play was an incredible actor, and we had an incredible production. And after we'd gotten good reviews and everything, he decided he wanted money and needed money to continue his career, and he refused to go on. And so the theater was filled with people, and nobody showed up. And then immediately, if anybody attended Jody Kretzmann's lecture last night, the media, of course, jumped on the bandwagon immediately and turned it into a huge racial issue, which it was not at the time. But it served, and it's a writer. I read a book. There's a book out on Minnesota theater, and it's kind of interesting because he said it was the most influential play done in the Twin Cities in the last 25 years. So I have that distinction because I directed the play, but I don't think it was for the reasons that I wanted it to be. The actor, by the way, is still around and acting. If you go to see Ghostbusters 2, he's the black Ghostbusters, and which is an interesting thing too. And he was there in the first film and was totally ignored, and then now finally they've sort of been forced to give him some billing on advertisements for. Pardon?
But he got money both times.
Oh, I'm sure he got. In fact, he still owes me $500, but I'm going to look him up someday. Black theater has shifted quite a bit over the last 20 years. And right now, probably one of the most popular playwrights in the country and one of the best playwrights in the country is a man by the name of August Wilson, who I again, through serendipity, I think had the good fortune to work with years ago before he was writing any famous stuff. He wrote a skit for me at a science museum that I was working at on Eskimos. But his most famous plays are Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Fences, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize, and his latest, most popular play is a play called Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And the interesting thing about August Wilson's plays now is that they are more of a middle road kind of production and play that, but more honestly, reflects the real black history. The oral tradition that's passed down through black culture and is and reflects what was happening in the 30s, the 40s. Joe Turner's Come and Gone is sort of a flip side of other literature that came out of the 30s and the early 1900s. The play is set in 1911. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is set in the 30s. And to go back and to bring the black culture up. And remember I said before World War II, everybody was trying to pretty much keep this sense of the melting pot. And it's nice that these authentic works, even though they're written in retrospect, are starting to come out. I want to keep going here very quickly and just briefly touch on some of the other things and the other types of theater that have brought been brought to the forefront. One of the largest unknown theater groups in this country is Chicano theater or Latino theater. There's very little of it known outside of the areas in which it's done. I don't know. Has anybody here seen any Chicano or Latino theater? What play?
Pachuco.
Pachuco.
Roosters and...
Roosters?
No, but this one also set in Miami. Cuban experience.
Okay. Anybody else?
Well, in Minneapolis, at the foot of the mountain, we put on a production that wasn't necessarily, but I can't remember what it was called.
Yeah, foot of the mountain does a lot of. But generally, throughout, there have been a few that have really made it big. Probably the most famous was Zoot Suit. Which
is the Pachuco.
Right.
Yeah.
Pachuco, which went to Broadway even and then got bombed in Broadway. It started in Los Angeles and went to Broadway. It starred Richard Olmos, who is pretty famous. He won an Academy Award last year or was nominated for Academy Award. Did he win for the... It's the story about the stand and deliver, the story about the teacher.
What does Pachuco mean?
I don't know. I don't speak Spanish. It refers to, because it's a character in another by Luis Valdez, it's the street smoothie. It's the, yeah.
Did you ask what a Pachuco and a suit is?
Well, yeah. I've never heard that since I was in the service.
There was an area in the Los Angeles area, which is where I grew up, say Echo Park, just south of the Civic Center, and briefly there were gangs. The Zoot Suit refers to their mode of dress, which was the striped pin suit, the wide shoulders and the narrow pants, and what made them different. The Pachucos from the Zoot Suiters was they used to always carry a shiv. I don't know if you know what a shiv is, but it's a knife that's like this. Their girlfriends at Belmont High School where I went, they would carry the shivs around during the day with their big pompadours. They'd slip them in, if you can believe that, in their pompadours. and yes, there was quite a gang of Pachucos, and it was how they ended was an interesting story, which I won't go into.
Well, I thought that it was a derogatory remark.
No,
It's a nickname more than necessarily.
Yeah. The Pachucas, as I say, were a gang of ruffians who, you know, were an offshoot and wore these Zoot Suits.
They had the
presented
tattoo.
A little differently in the play, but that's basically what they were.
They had the tattoo here, and. Many times, too, when they got through being gangs, they would want to get plastic surgery and try to get rid of that. And of course, that's a very difficult place.
And it's something reflecting for those that know Southern California today. Los Angeles is virtually an armed camp. Certain sections of Los Angeles, you take your life in your own hands if you drive through or you... You don't walk on the streets after dark, and you, above all, don't wear certain colors.
Red or blue.
Yeah, it's really sad, but it's an expression. In some ways, is theater, is high theater too. The whole gang movement is high theater to express themselves. Luis Valdez, who wrote Zoot Suit, started out in the 60s developing something called a company called El Teatro Campesino, which a campesino is a worker, a farm worker. And his whole purpose in developing this style of theater which he said was a theater of life, as opposed to what he felt were the sterile European-based theaters, which he thought were antiseptic or antibiotic, in other words, anti-life. And he believed that his company, El Teatro Campesino, was developing the kind of plays that would get people stirred up. He wrote a style of play that he called actos, and they're simple little acts or scenes or skits that were very simple. They were done with signs, with masks, very simple costumes, and they were taken on the back of trucks out to the fields. And his definition of what he believed Chicano theater is about, let me just read that. We're getting towards the end, so I'll close with this. Our belief in God, the church, the social role of women, these must be subject to examination and redefinition on some kind of public forum. A teatro of ritual, of music, of beauty and spiritual sensitivity. A teatro of legends and myths. A teatro of religious strength. This type of theater will require a couple of generations of Chicanos devoted to the use of theater as an instrument in the evolution of our people. Actos are designed to inspire the audience to social action, illuminate specific points about social problems, satirize the opposition, show or hint at a solution, and express what people are feeling. They're not made for reality, they're made for social vision. And they're created collectively through improvisation. Dealing with group archetypes. If anybody is interested, this is a book that I have with me, which contains some octos. I was going to read one. But they're very, they're almost like puppet plays. And many puppet theaters around the country in the 60s were doing plays that were very much like them. But they're social action plays. And they're developed from the people by improvisation and developed through that process of improvisation. The one other group that I really haven't talked about, and I'm going to quickly go over this, is the development of gay theater throughout, and especially over the last couple of years in terms of its involvement with the AIDS crisis. Two plays in particular have done more to galvanize a population and to educate a population than any, educate the population as whole, than any other form of education that's taken up this far. To me, it speaks very strongly for the power of theater. The two plays are As Is by William Hoffman and The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer, both of which have really done much to publicize and to educate. The South African issue has been primarily, up to this point, only been spoken through a white South African writer, Atoll Fugard, whose plays include Lesson from Allos, Master Harold and the Boys, The Road to Mecca, and a number of others, who's a very good, sensitive white writer to that issue. It's interesting to note that just this year, a black actor in South Africa played Othello with a white actress in front of a white audience. So things are really, really changing. 2 years ago, the same actor played in Miss Julie, another play with another white actress, and after he put his hand on the woman's thigh, half the audience got up and left. The next night, they had to have a double ring of guards to get the actors into the theater. And the next night after that, the theater was shut down by the government. So the power of theater still keeps working. And there are a lot of other voices that aren't being heard. Thank you so much. A lot of information. Thank you.